This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off this week. Coming up, billions of dollars in Postal Service's properties are being sold off to real estate developers. The United Nations says it has immunity and doesn't have to answer for the deaths of thousands of Haitians. And the roots of root working and mojo in black America. But first, the National Black Church Initiative says President Obama needs to face public condemnation for his drone assassinations program. Reverend Anthony Evans is executive director of the initiative, which he calls a faith-based coalition of 34,000 churches comprised of 15 denominations and 15.7 million African Americans. Reverend Evans says Obama's drone policies are evil.
The black church is very clear, and the Christian church in particular. Anything that any government or individual take into his hands the authority to take a life without justification, any justification, then the church has to speak to that. And what we are saying is that the president does not have the authority, even as president of the United States, to take anyone's life on a legal level. Period. So we reject capital punishment, and we certainly reject the drone policy when he said that he has the right, as President of the United States, to take anybody like who he deemed as a terrorist. He can deem anybody a terrorist. So which means to say it's evil and it's murder. So I can't describe it any other way, and it defies rationality.
And you invoke Jesus Christ, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King Jr., who famously described the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That was more than 40 years ago.
This goes to show you that Martin was accurate, and he was right about this. We are preparing this country to kill you if you do not conform. We just demonstrated it to the world. If you bomb the United States, we will spend $1 trillion to get you back. And that's exactly how much it took to get bin Laden. So, I mean, if that is the case, then we know better than the local thug who are just killing and do not have any respect of life. And so our country has taken on a policy that in itself violates all of our biblical teachings, our philosophical teachings, the teachings of even the UN. And Martin King and Jesus say violence can only be getting violence. So we can never expect justice and righteousness to flow in this country because we have a policy that we will kill you if we disagree with you.
The National Black Church Initiative draws upon organizations, churches that comprise about 16 million black people. You asked the question, where are you? Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Ben Jealous. Well, these are folks who claim to be black leadership.
Well, they are no leader at all, and we're beginning to every single day approve that. They have replaced their loyalty for God and serving African-American people to serving President Obama. Somehow President Obama has rose to mystical, and I hate to say some divine level in their eyes, that he can do no wrong. He can say no wrong. He can do no wrong. And everything against him is racism. It's not true. It's that his in itself is evil. How can the church support him killing? We don't support anybody killing, no less the President of the United States. So the whole question is, we have no leadership. We haven't heard from Jesse on this issue. Certainly we'll never hear from Al Sharpton because Al Sharpton is Obama's tight brother. Al decides who gets to the White House and who does not. He's the gatekeeper these days. And so as long as he's never going to say anything wrong about this president, largely because of the fact that Al has had a problem with every major president there is other than Obama. That makes Al a hypocrite. So does the NAACP. Well, you can buy the NAACP these days. So it's very clear with black leadership that they don't have any moral authority whatsoever.
So where is this dialogue, this argument occurring within the black church itself?
Well, it is occurring with our ministers and our denominations because we clearly understand that the U.S. drone policy is a contradiction to biblical teachings. We also understand that this president has contributed to destroying the black family by promoting homosexuality. So, I mean, it's very clear to us that every time he believes that he can do whatever he wants and that everybody will go along with it. And as much as I love our sisters, we don't hear from black women anyway on Obama. Again, they are so in love with Obama, and he can do no wrong. But we don't see him arguing the fact that he has not appointed a black woman on the Supreme Court. We don't see them arguing that he has fired two black women in his cabinet and have not appointed any black woman as of yet to his cabinet. So I'm just astonished of the silence of the most articulate voices that we have in our community who seem to allow this president to get away with whatever he wants to.
You seem to be describing a great passivity among black folks within the church as well as within the black political circles.
Oh, there's no question. They have given up in pressuring this president on any issue. When he got into office, there was 30% unemployment. Right now, today, 4 years, 5 years later, there's still 30% unemployment. When he got into office, black spending power was down some 54%. Today, black spending power is down 54%. When he got into office, black businesses was failing. Black businesses continued to fail, and they have dropped for the first time under this president than any other president. When he got into office, black foreclosure rate went sky high. It's still rising sky high. So there seems to be, among our black leadership, a passivity and also a sense of we don't want to rock the boat mentality to suffer quietly. We reject that approach. The black church, in its essence, in its form, mission is to call anyone to task that is violating our human and civil rights to participate fully as an American in the society. That means President Obama as well.
So can we expect black clergymen to be ringing the White House on the drone issue or any other issue?
Well, you will not get black clergy to do that. Sadly to say, you will not do that. I'm not sure what issues that they are so compelled to. That's why our organization have taken a courageous stand and denounced the president for this immoral policy that goes against biblical teachings and every human teachings there is. And we will continue to denounce this president if he gets out of bounds and he does not help black people.
That was Reverend Anthony Evans of the National Black Church Initiative speaking from Washington. Former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier failed to personally appear in a Port-au-Prince court to answer human rights violations allegations, although he did send his lawyer. Dan Beaton of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research has been keeping track of Duvalier since he returned to the scene of his crimes.
This was not the first time Duvalier failed to appear to respond to the court trying to try him for human rights crimes. There's a number of plaintiffs who claim they were victims of Duvalier when he was dictator for 15 years in the 70s and 80s. And the judge, fortunately, last year dismissed the human rights charges. So what this is an appeal by the human rights plaintiffs against that decision. So Duvalier is supposed to show up and present his side of it. Now there's another case related to this, which is that the judge did allow corruption charges against Duvalier to proceed. So he is about to be tried for corruption. You know, he stole hundreds of millions of dollars from the Haitian treasury, which he spent on himself and his family, took a lot of that money with him in exile. Some of those assets were later frozen and so on. So anyway, Duvalier himself is appealing that ruling, the corruption charges ruling. So he's kind of put himself in an awkward situation because if he continues not to show up, he can't, of course, continue with his appeal against the corruption charges. But by showing up, of course, it would be the first time he's actually in court with some of his victims who are trying to sue him and would result in the, hopefully, in the human rights charges being accepted in that trial proceeding.
Many, of course, were shocked that he would even return to Haiti at all. But his guy, a fan of Duvalier, is now president of Haiti, Sweet Mickey Martelly.
Yeah, that's Sweet Mickey, as he's, you know, known. That's his stage name. this popular compa singer. Well, he used to entertain Duvalier's Tanta Mercoutes and other Duvalier regime personnel back in the 80s at a nightclub and so on. And Martelli himself is admitted to being a former Tanta Mercoutes. So he's known to be pretty close to the Duvalier regime, and even before he was president on the campaign trail was talking about possible amnesty for Duvalier as well as for Aristide. Now, of course, what kinds of charges would be brought against Aristide still remains to be seen. Aristide also is back in Haiti and has yet to be tried for anything. And different Haitian authorities and the U.S. government have been trying to come up with any kind of evidence they could use against Aristide for years and years and haven't been able to come up with anything. So there's been very worrying signals from the Martelly government about Duvalier.
Duvalier was responsible for thousands of deaths of Haitians, and thousands more died under U.S.-backed military regimes. And now 8,000 have died in a cholera epidemic that was introduced by the new occupiers, the United Nations.
The U.N. finally, after 12 over a year, responded to a complaint filed at the U.N. by over 6,000 cholera victims and filed by the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti on their behalf that the U.N. is responsible for causing this cholera epidemic. Of course, as your listeners know, it was the U.N. so-called peacekeepers, troops from Nepal that brought the cholera epidemic to Haiti, and the U.N. has refused to own up to this. The victims want the U.N. to pay for water and sanitation infrastructure, as well as to compensate the victims and to issue a formal apology. So the U.N. said basically that they're immune from these charges, and that's really unacceptable. It's just a real travesty. It's a slap in the face, and it shows just a failure of the U.N. system that they would do this.
So the U.N. says it's immune as if it is a sovereign and has the rights of sovereign immunity. I guess Haiti has no sovereignty in Haiti.
Certainly people could make that argument. I mean, why are these U.N. troops there in the first place? They have no legitimate rationale to be there. There's no armed conflict when they went in 2004. There's no armed conflict now. There was no peacekeeping agreement that would call for their presence. And as I've mentioned on your show before, year after year when they have to get their mandate renewed, they try to come up with a new rationale to justify their presence there. I suppose in a way, lucky for them, the earthquake came along, and I don't want to sound too callous. I know they lost a number of personnel themselves in the earthquake, tragically, but that did give them a justification for their presence for the next several years at this point. And then they're always talking about the new elections. You know, they need to stay there to ensure the next round of elections can continue in a fair and peaceful way. Well, of course, the last elections, which put Martelly in office, were anything but fair. The largest political party was excluded, Fanly Lavalas, and the U.S., of course, directly intervened with the OAS to overturn the results of the first election and ensure that Martelly would be able to run in the runoff, which is ultimately how he got into office. So why the MINUSTAH is there is anybody's guess, and really demonstrates Haiti really does lack de facto sovereignty at this point, sadly.
Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, personally telephoned Haiti's president to inform him that the UN is claiming immunity in Haiti's deadly cholera epidemic and will not pay compensation to the victims. The suit against the UN was brought by the Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, directed by attorney Brian Concannon. Attorney Izeli Danto is head of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network. She thinks the suit was doomed from the start.
Well, it's not surprising to us at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. You know, we've had big problems with Concannon and the folks that went to the UN asking for the UN to find itself guilty. At the very beginning, in October 2010, Glenn, when the cholera epidemic came to Haiti, as of that time, 8,000 Haitians, over 8,000, and we can't really know all the numbers because lots of people are dying outside of being able to be counted, and 600 and 20,000 have been infected, and 200 are getting infected every day. And this is the most virulent form of the bacteria that has never been found in the Western Hemisphere until the Nepalese soldiers brought it in October 2010, and Haiti has never had cholera. Now, 15 months after the Konkanen group brought in their letter of demand to the UN, the UN just said that they're claiming immunity. But I'm not surprised, because Ira Kurzban was one of the first attorneys, and he represented President Aristide, who said to us, when we said we have to sue, we will look into this, because I said that the best way to do this, because the UN owns the court at The Hague, and so why are we going there? And besides, the jurisdiction is states and states, and getting advisory from the UN is like having the UN investigate itself. It appoints the judges over there. So there's just nothing to do but to do something different, something that will set a different precedent. And at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, we said this was a personal injury caused outside of operational necessities of the SOFA agreement, which is the status of force agreement that brings the UN formally to Haiti in 2004. So we said this would be a personal injury, a wrong for death, that the UN did not have the mechanism in their SOFA agreement to address that, because they have a single claims provision. So we had asked for help, because we don't have the staff at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. It's almost a solo work with all the work that I do, and I needed a law firm that had money and the staff and that would use our narrative. Obviously, he ended up going with Konkanen. He's on his board, and they sit on that board with Paul Farmer, who is the UN deputy envoy to Haiti at the time, and who himself was the UN face, apologizing and saying that Haiti's weak system is the cause of this. So we saw lots of problems with the demand of the Konkanen, Marie-Joseph, Ira Kurzban group at the UN, and we are not surprised at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership as to what's going on. I can say that our narrative is different as Haitians. What we say is that we have to look at the United States, number one. This is a U.S. occupation that is using a mask of U.N. guns. So for us, the U.N. is in Haiti in order to service U.S. needs. That's a period. So if, as a lawyer, you're looking at this scenario and you have this, and you forget about all of the politics and foreign relations and so forth that's going on with imperialism, you look straight at it and you say, as respondent superior, we name the U.S. because they call the shots. We name the U.N. because their soldiers brought it in. And we say from the beginning in 2004 that the SOFA agreement, the operating agreement that brings the U.N. to Haiti, is illegal. So anything that happens is the fruit of a rotten tree. It's illegal because it was not signed by a duly elected Haitian government or duly elected Haitian prime minister, but an imposed prime minister that came into Haiti and signed the SOFA agreement, Gérald Laporture, who is a 40-year UN employee, signed the agreement by which the UN is claiming immunity for the cholera cases. That's number one. Number two, even within that SOFA agreement, that status of force agreement, and we say that the UN, even under the privileges and immunities of the United Nations, they cannot claim absolute immunity. Immunity was only given in order for the UN to carry out its businesses and not be plagued with suits that are frivolous. Absolute immunity does not mean impunity. And we say that the UN itself waived its immunity in various ways, and I'll give you two ways. They signed the SOFA agreement. So if we just arguably say that the SOFA agreement was a legal document, within that agreement, there are articles that exempt from absolute immunity personal harm that a troop member from the UN or an employee did. So we say that they implied or expressly waived the UN immunity under the SOFA Article 5, Paragraph 23, and if that's not found to be operative, we say under Article 7, Paragraph 54, which provides a mechanism for third-party personal injury resolution, so long as the injury does not arise from operational necessity. Under that article, it's not an operational necessity for the UN to dump its raw sewage into Haiti's river and thereby killing 8,000 people. That is a wrong for death. If we agree that inadvertently they did it, it was an accident, then there is a provision under the SOFA agreement, what the UN itself claims that it would put together a claims commission to look at that personal injury. We say that very provision is a waiver of UN absolute immunity. Now, the fact that they never set up the claims commission also makes the UN in violation of the SOFA agreement, but definitely it's a waiver of absolute immunity just by having that there. And Article 5, Paragraph 3, I believe, is the one that said that the UN is to maintain their system in accordance with the health regulations that they themselves have put out for the world to sign. Most of the UN member countries have signed this WHO convention with regards to how they get rid of their sewage. And the UN, under the SOFA agreement, is obligated to do that in the same way. So we say that they did not follow their own convention of health. And so that's also a waiver of their absolute immunity because they said that they will be subject to that. Now, to find otherwise, to find that the UN is absolutely immune would turn the operation of international and national law on its head. And under the circumstances, absolute UN immunity, we say, under the circumstances, absolute UN immunity would render meaningless the very purpose of the UN's existence. Immunity is not impunity, and if so, that would be inconsistent with the instrument creating the UN and the member states' intentions to promote equality before the law.
And especially since you say that the United Nations is acting as an employee of the United States and the United States should be the one to be sued, well, the United States policy remains to subjugate Haiti, so why would the employee, the United Nations, do anything different?
Exactly. Now, I'm so disappointed with my own profession because I tell you, for the last 2 years, I've gone to every major law firm. I've gone to everyone. Most of our country has moved so to the right. It's not the time of Thurgood Marshall where they looked at precedents and challenged them in court and their illegality in court in terms of people's human rights. So what this is saying is that the U.S. policy abroad and the U.N. acting as its agent, the U.N. is what, a super state that is not subject to the very laws that it's promulgating for other countries to sign to, like the health laws, of, I think it's the health law for 2005, which prohibits what they just did, which prohibits states from doing this, from bringing in communicable diseases and spreading deadly viruses. Now, the U.N., who is supposed to be the arbiter of this under the WHO, the World Health Organization, is the one doing it, and it's saying it's absolutely immune. So that's where we are in the world. I thought that as a lawyer, I would find a courageous lawyer with the deep pocket and the firm to do what Thurgood Marshall did, because Thurgood Marshall and those of the days gone by had not tested, I mean, from way back to Dred Scott, the precedents, the customs that said that we were three-fifths of human beings and we were not allowed human rights, then I wouldn't be sitting here. So I have been begging lawyers all over the world to come and stand with the Haitian lawyers leadership and let us try to set a precedent. Let us break the precedent for the world, because the UN is out here doing the bidding of the World War II powers. And since Lumumba, folks like me and others have understood what the UN stands for, because the U.S. can strong-arm the little states and buy their vote any moment of the day. So we know where we are. But the firemen, the white progressive firemen to the UN arsonists, they play good cop, bad cop, and this 15 months, that's happened since the time that the Konkanen, Kurzban, and other folks brought in this case, this meaningless asking the UN to investigate itself or to find itself guilty, which I have said from the beginning is like asking the rapist, tell us if you actually raped this woman. It just makes no sense that the UN could be investigator, judge, and jury of itself and find something other than what it just found yesterday.
And in fact, what the United States does is to use the UN as a kind of super state in order to do that which the United States cannot do itself. For example, Haiti has been reduced to what we've described as a kind of protectorate of the UN with no national rights.
Exactly. And just recently in the news, you have announcements that the U.S. is building prisons in Haiti. I mean, that's very familiar to us black folks. I mean, that's what they do. They warehouse our people. And so the earthquake happens, 320,000 and more Haitians die in 33 seconds. the U.S. puts Clinton in the U.N., the first time in U.N. history that the World Bank is their banker, and that's only for Haiti. So you know what's going on. And they collect, I think, $7.5 billion, according to the New York Times. And yet, the New York Times says that there's no footprint has been left. They've used the reputation of progressiveness, just like they're using the black skin of Obama to go into Africa and recolonize it. They used Paul Farmer to make as if this occupation was something moral, doing something good for Haiti because of their reputation with regards to the good doctor. But that good doctor has sold out, and he is the head of the 40 or so thousand NGOs, non-for-profits, who are lapping up that $7.5 billion while my folks are dying of all sorts of crises and diseases and so forth. Haiti's worse off a million times than in 2004 than before the internationals came in and took it over. So as you say, it is a protectorate, and we've become a penal colony. But the white folks in Haiti, the big NGOs, they've got maids and butlers and children they can go ahead and sexually molest. It's like a little Dixieland over there. We're back into the plantation.
That was attorney Azeli Danto of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, speaking from Connecticut. The United States Postal Service is being forced to the brink of bankruptcy. Along the way, the vast properties and art accumulated by the Postal Service over hundreds of years are being sold off to private corporations. Gray Brechlin of the Living New Deal Project says we are watching a daylight bank heist with no cop on the beat.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. My parents and grandparents paid for the post offices and the art that's in them. And so I became quite alarmed last year when I began to find out that all of it's being put on the market, all of it's being sold, and this is our property. So it really is a bank heist. And what I meant by there's no cop on the beat is that the press has been virtually missing an action on this whole thing. They have covered the sale of individual post offices, but not what's happening around the country with the sale of these properties, as well as the art that's in them, which belongs to all of us, too, the art that was painted during Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal to reflect us as Americans back to ourselves.
And the agent of the sale of the U.S. Postal Service's property is the well-connected head of this corporation called CBRE. This sounds like what happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where the oligarchs gobbled up the public property.
That's a very good analogy. Yes, what's really happening is that our property has been turned over, in effect, to the world's largest commercial real estate company, which is chaired and largely owned by Richard C. Blum. He is the billionaire private equity investor husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein, probably the most powerful senator in Congress. So although Feinstein's office has denied that she and her husband ever discussed business, that there is an absolute firewall between her service of the public interest and his rapacious acquisition. In fact, of course, they share community property. And so the profits that Richard Blum is making on the sale of our property becomes their property. And so it's really quite outrageous. And again, the press has been completely missing in action on this conflict of interest. I think it's really shocking. What we're seeing is something like the great land frauds in the 19th century, when the railroads and various others of the robber barons got hold of the public domain. But at that time, the public domain was largely out in the country. It was the rural areas. What we're seeing in the 21st century is they're going after these very valuable pieces of real estate, which are right in the heart of all of our cities, because that's where the post offices were located. They were located in the exact heart of the cities because they had to serve the central business districts and help to grow them, as well as the people, of course, who lived in those cities. And now that very valuable real estate is being put on the market and profiting a senator and her husband.
And we would have to add that those cities are now largely minority and will not have those resources to deal with in terms of economic development. They'll belong to private parties.
Yes, that's right. The inner cities, of course, are largely, many of them, are largely populated by minorities this time, although it also includes some of the thriving cities as well, too. But the Postal Service just announced that it will be selling the Central Bronx Post Office, for example. That, of course, is a largely black area. And that's really shocking because not only does it serve the community and the businesses there, but it includes 13 murals by the great American artist Ben Shahn, which show people working in textile mills and various other industries because Shahn said that he wanted people in the Bronx to know the way that Americans outside of New York City live. And those murals are, which we paid for, are probably worth more than the building and the real estate that it's on. But it's not just that either. It's also that the Postal Service itself, which is being dismantled by what is really a vast right-wing conspiracy, the Postal Service has traditionally been the route by which many minorities, especially African Americans, have made it into the middle class ever since the great postal strike of 1970, which enabled the unions to become much more powerful than they had been. The Postal Service has provided living wage jobs, and there are strong unions in the Postal Service, and the right wing that wants to dismantle the Postal Service and is wants to smash those unions because it's just like a red flag for a bull that they even exist. The U.S. Postal Service is the second largest employer in the country after Walmart, but unlike Walmart, it provides living wage jobs. Now, you could imagine what is going to happen when the current Postmaster General, if he's successful, he will eliminate, as he says, 220,000 postal jobs. That's about half of the current workforce. Well, that will be an enormous blow to the U.S. economy as well as, of course, to the workers who are making living wage jobs right now.
That right-wing conspiracy against the Postal Service that you speak of is certainly not limited to Republicans, though. Feinstein's not a Republican, and the Obama administration has been, well, of no help.
No, you're right. It really is bipartisan, although it largely comes out of the Republican Party, and I should say the T-Wing branch, the Koch brothers-funded aspect of the Republican Party. But you're absolutely right. Democrats have been behind it, too, and Obama doesn't really seem to care. I've heard from people in Washington that I know that Obama also believes that the Postal Service is somewhat obsolete. It's 19th century. I mean, he really is a technocrat. He doesn't really have a sense of the public service which the post office is meant to serve. It wasn't meant to be a business, a profit-making business. It's meant to serve a public service. And so ideally it should be actually supported by our taxes as it once was up until 1970-71 because it's a public service. But Obama has really been no help at all. If you look at the Board of Governors that runs the Postal Service, they're largely right-wingers and people from the corporations that were appointed by George W. Bush. The problem is that Obama's appointments haven't been any better so far. He just appointed somebody who I believe sits on the board of the Cato Institute, which is one of the right-wing think tanks, which has come up with papers to totally privatize the Postal Service. So Obama really is not that much better.
And of course, the direct beneficiaries will be FedEx and UPS and whatever other private entities jump out there to fill the gap that has been deliberately created.
Yes, what you've got is FedEx and UPS and Pitney Bowes, these private carriers and businesses, which would love to have not only the business of the U.S. Postal Service, but to eliminate a public rival, which provides very efficient and low-cost service. And once it's gone, of course, then they can charge anything that the traffic will bear. And already it's very expensive if you use one of the private carriers to mail first-class mail. It's going to be far more so if the Postal Service is eliminated as an option. Now, those carriers are members of the group called ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. And ALEC is an organization that drafts very reactionary legislation such as been carried in the state houses of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, et cetera, that they've taken over. And they seem to be behind the legislation in 2006, which is what's killing the U.S. Postal Service. But you also have the right-wing think tanks like Cato and American Enterprise. All of these and others have drafted white papers for the what they call the reform of the U.S. Postal Service. And that reform is, in fact, a code word for murder. And that's actually what's happening right now. Those white papers that the right-wing think tanks have done are being implemented largely through an act in 2006 passed by Congress that requires the Postal Service to prepay retirements for 75 years in the future in just the next 10 years, something that no other business is required to do. It was done very cleverly because many people didn't realize the implications of that, including actually the unions that thought that it was in their favor. But now what's happening about 6 years later is that it's actually killing the Postal Service itself because it's bankrupting it.
Which was the intent?
Yes, I think it was definitely the intent right along, but it was done very cleverly so that many people didn't understand what it was except for the right-wing think tanks and ALEC that were behind the drafting of that legislation and the Congress people who were taking money from the private carriers and from the members of ALEC.
In terms of the Postal Service art properties that are embedded in their holdings, it would be very difficult to attach a price to that. But what is the estimate of the value of the real estate itself?
The conservative estimate of the value of the real estate in the U.S. Postal Service portfolio is about $110 billion, though nobody really knows, because it includes enormously valuable pieces of real estate, large pieces of real estate, right in the center of many of our cities. But $110 billion, if that's what it's worth, is nothing to sneeze at. Anybody who can get their hands on that kind of property is going to make a very large amount of money. And so this company, CBRE, C.B. Richard Ellis, essentially has not only the exclusive contract to sell our properties, but also to lease out other properties for the U.S. Postal Service, because what it's doing is selling property that it owns to then lease property that it doesn't own that it will move into. So in the very short term, it will provide some income to the Postal Service, but in the long term, it'll essentially cost it. So it will increase the death spiral that's going on right now. I should add that CBRE took a real hit in the real estate crash in 2008. Its stock dropped sharply. And so when this property became available, the properties of the USPS, it went aggressively after the contract to sell those properties. It had what it called a pursuit team to go after it. Now, we don't have any definite proof that Senator Feinstein intervened on her husband's behalf, but you can bet that having a chair of the board who's married to the most powerful senator in Congress certainly couldn't have hurt in getting the contract for CBRE.
Seems like that company is being allowed to milk the cow as it leads it to slaughter.
Exactly. Yes, that's a very good analogy.
Gray Brechlin of the Living New Deal Project. Dr. Katrina Hazard Donald has a new book titled Mojo Workin', The Old African-American Hoodoo System. Dr. Hazard Donald is director of the Africana Studies and Research Program at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey. We asked her, how old is hoodoo and what makes it a belief system?
I got interested in writing about this topic when I asked that question. Most of us think of hoodoo, we think of the curio shop downtown, or now it's dominated by internet salespeople. But as I looked at the kind of material that were being offered for sale and the kind of discussion that was being generated around these sales, something was missing, and a lot of it didn't make sense to me. And so I began to investigate hoodoo. I had grown up in a community where people practiced hoodoo. It was actually practiced in my home. But what I was seeing on the internet and what I was seeing in the curio shops was completely disconnected. So I began to investigate hoodoo. I knew that we could not have developed the kind of material culture that was being sold in hoodoo. For example, hot foot powder and money drawing oil and jinx removing candles. And so I began to investigate, well, where could this stuff have come from? This certainly had very little to do with African-American tradition. So I began to delve around and investigate and ask a bunch of questions. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I got interested in it inadvertently because I was a dancer. And many of the dances that I learned, especially when I started studying West African dance, was tied to the religion. And the way that African traditional religion in the New World is talked about, hoodoo was excluded. So one of the things I wanted to do was to examine why it had been excluded and to bring it into the discussion on African traditional religion in the New World.
Well, what's the difference between a practice, which may be of dubious authenticity, and a system? You call it the old African-American hoodoo system.
One of the things I believed is that hoodoo at one point had to have been a full-fledged religion. And what we were looking at today was, in fact, the remnants, the residuals of what was once a full-fledged and fully functioning religion, systematically organized with its supply lines, its supply networks, its religious sacred dances, just as you find in voodoo and Santeria and Macumba and the other African manifestations of traditional religion on this side of the Atlantic. And so I began to look at disconnected practices and to see if somehow in the past they had been linked in a cohesive whole, an actual system that actually functioned as a religion. And as I delved back through a wide range of literature, I began to piece together what appeared to be, in fact, an actual religion and an actual system. Now, Michael Edward Bell had taken the work of Harry Middleton Hyatt, the five volumes written by Harry Middleton Hyatt on hoodoo and conjure. He had taken Harry Middleton Hyatt's work and examined it and retitled his dissertation to talk about hoodoo as if it had a logic. The way hoodoo appears in the curio shops and at the hands of what I call marketeers is sort of a disconnected series of gestures that have to do with luck and jinxing. Michael Edward Bell, when he examined Harry Middleton Hyatt's work, came to the conclusion that this stuff was not randomly organized, that it was systematically organized, and that it was logical and reasonable, and that you could map the logic, and he did. But he fell short of calling it a religion. And most of the scholars, in fact, all of the scholars that have written about it, except me, have been reluctant to call it a religion.
So when I was a kid in Georgia, the lady down the road who people called the root woman, and some were somewhat afraid of her, she was practicing a vestigial element of a previous religion or of a religion.
She was practicing the vestiges of what I call the old hoodoo religion. And it had its sacred dance, just as Santeria has its sacred dances, just as voodoo has its sacred dances. And the sacred dance of the old hoodoo religion is the ring shout.
Were you able, historically, to pinpoint at least a ballpark era when the religion began breaking down into disconnected parts?
I think that it starts to break down after emancipation. After emancipation, you get two things happening. You get it congealing and existing at its full bloom for the first time because it's freed from the bond, and it's here that it is organized into a complete system. You have the midwives who are still procuring umbilical cords and placentas and those sacred veils from those children that are born with the veil. All of that is controlled by midwives. So you have the midwives, you have conjurers, and many of them are women, but they're primarily men. You also have root doctors, separate from conjurers. You also have grave diggers and the role of undertakers as part of this complete system. But let me back up. When this thing emerges, what made me ask the question, and what I think is the essential question, is a simple childlike question that all scholars seem to have been ignoring. For example, when you read the work of Bishop Daniel Alexander Payne and you read the notes that he kept on the conversion ceremonies that he conducted after emancipation, from 1877 on, he conducted mass conversion ceremonies, revivals all over the South in which people were saved and converted to Christianity. And one consistent theme emerged that I noticed as I was reading this material. The slaves all wanted, and the ex-slaves all wanted, to bring the ring shout into their conversion, and they refused to be converted without it. And so much of the literature describes this, and he has to tolerate it. In fact, he does tolerate it, and he allows people to form these dancing rings. And one account I read said that sinners would not be saved if you didn't have a ring over yonder, another ring over here, and another ring over there, or sinners won't get saved. So the question is this: if they want to bring the ring shout into Christianity, what were they bringing it out of? That's a simple question.
And you're saying they broke that?
I'm saying that they had to have brought it out of a context that sustained it for the 250 years it had existed. And then in order for our context to do that, it had to achieve some level of stability and some level of institutional existence. And I say that that old institution was the old hoodoo religion.
And then at some point after emancipation, we got jacklegs and...
I say you begin to get those in large and influential numbers once you begin to get European immigration into the country in the 1890s. That's when it starts to happen.
And how does that impact upon these free black communities?
Well, a couple of things are occurring simultaneously. After 1877, when federal troops are withdrawn from the South, this reign of terror begins. You get the rise of the KKK. You get massive pogroms against black people. Homes are burned. Communities are attacked. And so there is an element that is pushing us out of the South. At the same time, there's the rise of industry in the North. You have the cutting off of European immigration, so now you have a shortage of white labor in the North at a time when labor is in demand because more and more factories are being built and we're rapidly industrializing. You get the recruitment of black folks out of the Deep South, and Floriette Henry does a wonderful job of documenting it in her book, Black Migration. And as we leave the South, we leave many of those customs behind. We literally disconnect from those old networks, and we move into the urban North. And we confront something here that we had not confronted before. It is also a time of increasing literacy. So you have all these factors coming together. European immigrants coming into the country, many of them are Jewish chemists who cannot get jobs in the United States. And so they take to exploiting the black trade in hoodoo, dream book, and black makeup. And you get the birth of these hoodoo curio shops. And for the first time, you get these people advertising in black newspapers. And so I went through a whole series of black newspaper ads. And from the 1880s onward, these ads start to appear as a trickle at first. And then as we get deeper and deeper into the 1890s, they start to explode. And after World War I, they explode all over the black newspapers and all the other black publications as well, the black magazines as well. And in fact, after World War II, the black targeted magazines are supported exclusively by hoodoo ads, most of them by people who are jacklegs. Very rarely would you find an old tradition root worker who really came out of the old tradition advertising in any of these places. Usually you would find one of those people in the church. And they would never admit to being able to work hoodoo, but they would always admit to being able to remove it.
And so we see this period of largely non-black entrepreneurial exploitation leading to these items for sale that we see still today.
The actual fabrication of items, war water and peace water, hot foot powder. And, of course, all of these things are outsider attempts to drain dollars out of the black community, exploit our belief systems, exploit the disconnection from our belief systems, and because we are disconnected from it, we're disconnected from the old authority, and now we have a new authority who are primarily Ashkenazi Jewish immigrants. coming into the country in the 1890s, 1900s, and then again in the early 1930s. And you see these shops just explode all over black communities. The old hoodoo drugstores you found in the South, and they offered a few items that people would use in hoodoo. For example, you could go in and get High John the Conqueror root, which was jalap root, used mainly to make laxatives. You could go in and get bluestone and other types of chemicals that people would use in hoodoo. So they weren't actually a hoodoo supplier, but they were drugstores that supplied items that root workers could and did use. Of course, a lot of these get taken over by these immigrants, and the hoodoo trade and exploitation explodes. You can see them if you punch in hoodoo on the Internet today. There are thousands of them on the Internet now, literally thousands of people claiming to work hoodoo, claiming to teach you how to work hoodoo, people who claim that they were initiated by the Gullah, others who say, well, I learned this from the blacks, and on and on and on and on. I don't know if I answered your question, but I hope so.
Oh, you certainly did, and you seem to be exploring just those kinds of questions under the program that you direct at Rutgers University in Camden.
Well, the book and the program were sort of born for me at the same time. One of the things I wanted to do was to not only demonstrate that there was, once upon a time, an old tradition and a real hoodoo that this stuff gets generated from and imitating, and I wanted to talk about what the old system could possibly have looked like, what circumstances gave rise to it, and what was responsible for its disappearance. When hoodoo is born, in the early part of the book, I ask the question of how do a range of African ethnic groups become one people and produce one tradition? And I had to ask that question, how did hoodoo emerge? Some of us were Wolof speakers, some of us spoke Mande, some of us spoke Bambara, others of us spoke Ashanti. How do we become one people? And the story of how we become one people is the story of how all of these religious traditions become one hoodoo. When Africans are landed here, even though we're from a wide range of diverse backgrounds, there are certain elements in African culture that are highly recognizable to all Africans, especially all that come from that complex of cultures that our ancestors are drawn from. For example, all the African groups landed here recognized ancestor reverence. They all practiced ancestor reverence. They all practiced water immersions. They all practice counterclockwise sacred circle dancing, so that when that African got off that boat, even though he did not speak the language, and even though nothing else may have been familiar to him, that counterclockwise sacred circle was familiar to him. It was done in his ethnic group. It may have been done for different reasons, and it may have been done to a god with a different name, but it was recognizable. And there were eight distinct characteristics that I call the African religion complex that were highly recognizable by all the Africans that landed here. Ancestor reverence, spirit possession, water immersion, ritual divination, belief in a spiritual cause of malady, and herbal and naturopathic medicine. All of them practice those things. And it is out of those eight things that you get the recongelling and the remolding into what I call the old hoodoo religion. And the first deified saint of the old hoodoo religion was High John the Conqueror. The sacred dance of the old hoodoo religion was the ring shout. When you look at the way African traditions on this side of the Atlantic are talked about and discussed and handled, the African in North America is always excluded. We were left out of the discussion on African retentions because they just weren't visible. It wasn't until Melville Herskovitz came along and challenged that. Of course, Franz Boas did that even earlier than Herskovitz, but he does it inadvertently, and he's not answering a challenge. He's simply writing and observing what he saw. It's not until later that we become disconnected. In the minds of the scholars, we become disconnected from the rest of the Africans. And one reason that they're given is that, well, you know, you Negroes in North America didn't have the drum. Of course, we know now that we did have the drum secretly because they're digging them up on the old plantations now. Drums with Ashanti markings are being discovered. And so, yeah, the drum was outlawed. and we didn't have the drum, but we did have it. And so we've been excluded from that discussion. So one of the things I wanted to do was to demonstrate that the process was very similar for us here in North America, that we indeed are part of the African diaspora, that we indeed developed African religion into its own unique form. And just because it died, could not sustain itself, and all we have are the exploitable remnants of it, does not mean that it was not once a vibrant and fully functioning religion. And it was.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.